an angry nation? It's time, General, to stack our arms. In fact, that is the first step. That is my first request of you. Stack your arms and disband your army.
And who will enforce the laws once we have them?
The regular army. The police.
They're the ones we just fought and beat. Give me your watch. Give me your watch. Give it to me. It's a beautiful watch. Expensive. I'll take my rifle. Now you can have your watch back. But without this, never. You draw a strong moral. You ask us to disarm. How could we get our land? Or keep it if we disarm? But it's not that simple. It's a matter of time.
And time! Time is one thing to a lawmaker, but to a farmer there's a time to plant and a time to harvest. And you cannot plant and harvest time.
General Zapata, do you trust me?
Just the way my people trust me. I trust you and they trust me as long as we keep our promises. Not a moment longer. Where are you going?
I'm going home. What will you do there?
I will wait, but not for long.
White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, in the bunker right here in north central Indiana on a cool and drizzly day. Yesterday was beautiful sun's day, you know. But today we're back down in the cold, cold ground. Hey, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where we're going to stay for a while. Incidentally, we've got a new company to do our the same thing that we had PayPal doing. I'll be giving you the information probably tomorrow. And then you can send your April donations to that outfit. But we should have it all together tomorrow and we'll let you know. This outfit takes a lot less cut off the top. I think it's going to be a lot better than PayPal. However, so far they're only doing it in the United States. So, to send your donations from overseas, you'll need to send cash or international money order. Or something like that. I'm going to play an excerpt from a series that's relatively new. I believe it's on Netflix, called Strain. S-T-R-A-I-N. It's about all kinds of stuff. But mainly it's about viruses floating around, killing lots of people. But it's a lot more than that. They got the Nazis in it. They got everybody in it. They got spooky guys and monsters and everything. Anyhow, this is what the man from the CDC warned federal agents about, these viruses.
So what, the CDC should take a backseat on this one?
I agree. Yeah. Absolutely.
How often do you touch your face? In a day. How often?
I don't know. Once an hour?
Every 3 minutes. You have mouth-hand contact every 5 minutes. You touch somebody else every 20 minutes. That's how contagion works. You know, like terrorists try negotiating with a virus. A virus exists only to find a carrier and reproduce. That's all it does. And it does it quickly. It has no political views. It has no religious beliefs. It has no cultural hang-ups. And it has no respect for a badge. It has no concept of time or geography. It might as well be the Middle Ages, except for the convenience of hitching a ride on a metal tube flying from meal to meal to meal. That's how a plague begins.
Hey, did you hear that Hulk Hogan won a lawsuit? He's collecting $115 million off something about a sex tape that somebody put out on him. I'm going to play you a little clip about how the Indians with the dots on their heads took over the motel business, or at least the lower cost motels in this country. And it started with one illegal alien Indian.
Here you are. Enjoy. You're welcome. This is one of 52 hotels owned by Hershaw Hospitality Trust. J.H. Shaw is the CEO of the company.
My father named the company after my mother. Hersha is my mom's name.
Like a lot of second-generation Gujaratis in the hospitality business, Shaw built the company up from modest origins. One of his family's first properties was the Red Rose Motel in rural Pennsylvania. It had just 23 rooms. Shaw and his family lived behind the lobby.
There were a lot of chores to do. There was a lot of grass to cut. We'd skim the pool in the morning.
Shaw's father was an electrical engineer, but he'd always wanted to be an entrepreneur. That was common in the Gujarati community, according to Pavan Dingra. He's the chair of the sociology department at Tufts University.
They have a long tradition of working for themselves rather than working for someone else.
The fact that so many Gujaratis became motel proprietors is something of a historical accident. It started with Kanjapai Desai, an undocumented Gujarati immigrant who bought a motel in San Francisco in the early 1940s. As Dingra explains, his example inspired Indians who came afterwards.
Some of the pioneers stayed at his hotel where they got the idea of pooling their resources to run one themselves.
Gujaratis really began buying motels after 1965. That's the year the U.S. government began allowing in more people from developing nations. Now there are nearly 4 million people of Indian descent living here.
They really did change franchising.
That's Chandra Ruth, who teaches at Cornell School of Hotel Administration. He says Gujaratis played a huge role in the expansion of Best Westerns and Days Inns across the country. That's because they were willing to relocate to out-of-the-way places like Canton, Mississippi, or Plainville, Ohio.
Every small community in America today has a hotel or two as a result of this community taking some business risk and establishing a hotel.
Being the only Indian immigrants in these isolated communities could be tough. Benita Patel's parents owned hotels in North Carolina in the 1980s.
It was hard. I mean, I remember someone pulling a window down and yelling, "Go back to your own country," as we were walking home.
Gujarati families, though, stuck it out. And they did innovative things to make their motels profitable. They started the now common practice of placing a washer and dryer in the room behind the lobby. That way the person working at the front desk at night would have the sheets and towels ready for the next day. They also economized by doing a lot of the upkeep themselves. Patel and her brother were in charge of vacuuming her parents' Holiday Inn on the weekends.
We would vacuum as a team because neither one of us was strong enough to push the entire vacuum on our own.
As she got older, she graduated to running some of her family's properties. And now, as an adult, Patel wants to take the business to the next level. She takes inspiration from her friend and fellow second-generation Gujarati, J.H. Shaw. Hershaw Hospitality Trust, which began with that modest motel in Pennsylvania, is now a $2.5 billion company. For NPR News, I'm Alexandra Starr in New York.
You know, I usually read some mail to you, but perhaps I should not say who it comes from, because if people like Morris Slee's D's and the ADL people and just plain assholes are hanging out there trying to pick up details so they can run to whoever it is and complain, they're such candy asses. Anyhow, I'm going to not give you the name of who I'm reading the letter from, for their protection, not for mine. Thank you again for your kind, generous $25 donation this month. this cold front should be the last one this spring. One good thing about the Camp of the Saints situation in Europe, of the millions of non-white Muslims, mostly young, single men, invading our white ancestral homelands, is that it is destroying the European Union, a big part of the New World Order, and finally awakening and angering whites of Europe to actually see the genocide of their kind and culture, and are flushing liberalism down the toilet. Well, we saw it yesterday in the news. Rioting has already started to break out, I believe, in Belgium. And the people who were against letting the Muslims in were out there in mass, and the state, with their water cannons, were spraying them. So in other words, the people who want to protect Europe are being gone after by the cops. Interesting, isn't it? And finally, awakening and angering the whites of Europe to actually see the genocide of their kind and culture, and are flushing liberalism down the toilet. The witch, evil Merkel, is toast. She and her political party are done, dead meat. Many Germans are now openly speaking how Hitler was right and wishing he could be resurrected. Well, if he is resurrected, I hope he does it differently than involve himself in a world war, because sort of defeats the purpose. A new strong leader will be demanded by the time the Germans soon. Anyway, my brother will be mailing to you my 32-page petition for a hearing before the U.S. Supreme Court. We already have a docket number for it. Okay, that's it for that that note. Up until now, over there in Europe, they've been able, the system's been able to cover up the anger of the people by claiming it's all the right-wingers. But now it's the so-called right-wing are melding into the crowd and in the streets. And so they can't say that anymore, but so now they're attacking them. The system is attacking the people in the streets. Nothing starts a revolution or a civil war like the system attacking the people, common people in the streets. So that was needed, and that's going to help out. That's going to do a lot of good as far as I'm concerned. And I hope as far as you're concerned. Going to have our reporter read to you an interesting speech about the Jews fragmenting. And it was given at a university in Southern California. And I think you'll find it quite interesting, because it's interesting to see what the Jews have to say about their own problems. So let's listen to this.
My approach to clarity is to go to the ambiguous side, or to put it more highly.
Well, I did it again. there's a little glitch I keep failing to do here. Wait a minute.
My approach to clarity is to go to the ambiguous side, or to put it more high-mindedly, to turn to Wittgenstein's concept of family resemblances. The Jews, in other words, exemplify the sort of social entity Wittgenstein spoke of as a complicated network of similarities overlapping and crisscrossing. There are, in the case of the Jews, as Wittgenstein said, overall similarities, and he went on, I can think of no better expression to characterize these similarities than family resemblances. For the various resemblances between members of a family, build, features, color of eyes, gait, temperament, etc., etc., overlap and crisscross in the same way. All manner of qualities and boundaries are stirred together in that, etc., etc. Doctrinal, institutional, legal, textual, ritual, national, and whatnot. Seen from within or without, there are resemblances but not identity. Curious, then, and interesting, that concepts like Jewish identity should be hazy at the boundaries. It is not irrelevant that Wittgenstein was himself baffled about being a Jew. Three of his four grandparents were Jewish, but one of them, his paternal grandfather, born Moses Meyer, became a Protestant and changed his middle name to Christian. This might well be a biographical root for his interest in family resemblances. The genealogy of Jewish identity as a problem is ancient. It can't be denied that, for centuries, the complicated network of the Jewish condition was, and continues to be, channeled through an overlapping obsession with a story contained in a book, by identification with it, as in the people of the book, and by contestation within it, with the effort to know, cherish, and preserve that book, and to honor those who take it seriously, to recite, decipher, and dispute it, to try to manage its contradictions, to honor the chain of commitments and sacrifices described there, to use chapters and verses of that book against other chapters and verses, aspiring always to make sense of a world full of absence in which the one certainty about life is that it ends. The most important activity of an honorable Jew was to study the book which told the story of a tribe that was anointed as God's deputies on earth, along with the sanctioned commentaries on it. The people of Abraham, father of many, found it beneficial, or at least comforting, to confront, or evade, radical mysteries of their existence in the company of a tribe equipped with, if nothing else, a common vocabulary. The Jews had a story that featured them. There was convergence on that story concerning a unique and immensely powerful deity who created the world and flooded it to punish a failed species, saving only the line of Noah, a uniquely just man, and who later came to an otherwise undistinguished descendant of Noah called Abram, and spoke to him, and set him toward a destination in Canaan, otherwise undistinguished as well, and set him on his journeys and his tasks, and arranged for an endpoint in a land whose meaning to them derived strictly from the fact that it had been designated by God. As you know, a great deal ensued, including rituals, miracles, enemies, exiles, escapes, the delivery of commandments and the setting of laws, and eventually, defeat and centuries of diaspora, vastly longer than the time of the Jewish state, and further on, throughout all the failures and defeats, the punishments meted out for their failures to do well by their assignments, millennial yearnings for a return to the Holy Land. Even Jews who disdained any foothold in the varieties of doctrinal Judaism felt the calling to locate themselves on a map whose once and enduring center was in Jerusalem. Jerusalem was what you had a relationship to, even if that relationship was mysterious, abstract, and hypothetical. The language of Jewish longing for a surpassing, redeeming deliverance was saturated with a hunger for Zion even in the breasts of Jews who were not Zionists. The Jews were the beneficiaries of a particular kind of story. It was not just a narrative of characters and events of the form A did X to B, upon which C happened. It was not a story prescribed for a self-contained tribe. It was a morality tale that traced variations on an overpowering theme. A single God chose a single man to engender a singular people. Here's what happened when they tried to live up to their mission, tried and failed, tried, failed, and tried again. In the Jews' story, the age of gods in the plural was now to be overshadowed, and the age of God had arrived. This designated people told a story about themselves in which their story was central because the single God whom they recognized, different from all the gods who were of surpassing value to all other peoples, determined that they should matter, because he had chosen them and not to worship a local god but to be the people of the single god. The single god was not only their god, the local god of their tribe, but the god, God in the singular, everyone's god, whether they knew it or not. So, a universalist claim is built into the history of the Jews. God hammers it home when he addresses all the Jews in the world from Mount Sinai, after finally delivering them from bondage. The Jews are a particular people charged with universal significance. If you like that paradox, you like the Jews. The covenant declares a mission that exists not only for God and for the Jews but for the others. As it is written in Genesis 12:3, by you shall all families of the earth be blessed. All families of the earth. There were others, Goyim, Ausländer, to contend with. In a word, the Jews were designated a people among peoples, with a particular mission and task, Jewish exceptionalism. To be for themselves in the name of being for others, and for others in the name of being themselves. Not to be a people but the people on behalf of the people. The logic was circular but weirdly compelling, as was it also perplexing to the people whom God singled out. The story mattered because the single God must have known that there were other peoples holding to other gods. The Talmudic story of the young Abraham makes the destruction of idols a proof of virtue. In fact, the idea of chosenness was not unique to the Israelites. But, unlike other people's parallel claims, it persisted even as the meaning of chosenness proved elusive and even obscure. It was the inescapable magnet for Jewish identity. And perhaps for this reason it had the probably unintended effect of provoking a zero-sum challenge to all the peoples left unchosen. As Leo Leibovitz and I wrote in The Chosen Peoples, America, Israel, and the Ordeals of Divine Election, the Promised Land's native inhabitants struggled against a theology that declared them to be, in effect, the children of a lesser God. When they resisted becoming history's beautiful losers, they construed their defeats as martyrdom, built identities around humiliation, set out to regenerate themselves through acts of magic and will, and began to rationalize the next war. The later Abrahamic religions developed their own forms of either-or chosenness. They too recognized the power of the idea, the universal in the particular. Even toward the end of the 20th century, 50% of a national sample of American Jews conducted by the sociologist Stephen M. Cohen said they agreed with the statement, Jews are a chosen people. Breaking out of the ghetto, the Jewish Enlightenment altered, widened and complicated the scope of Jewish ideals. Some Jews who entered the outside world, in Cohen's words, universalized what had been a particularist civilization. But it was a particularist civilization with a difference. They would take up the Hebrew language but they would also sign up with ways to belong to distinct nations. For these Jews, there was not only an opportunity but an imperative to return to one or another version of the divine election that stemmed from their origin to open the Jews up to broader Enlightenment currents of thought, to enlarge and in part secularize Jewish education, to make the Jew a citizen of the world, equipped, or saddled, with ethical obligations, even to point the way. A universalist tendency had long been latent in the cloistered Judaism of Europe. Now, let free, it could flourish. What was good for the Jews would be to complete Hillel's triad, to be for ourselves, to be for others, and to be all that now. In other words, the Jews in the diaspora were a people of ethics. Exiles did not cease, and new homelands were founded. Under pressure, many European Jews flocked to varieties of the secular left and then, eventually, under the pressure of oppression, to to Zionism, which, although ostensibly secular, carried in its bones a millennial spirit of return to the biblical homeland. In America, Jews went to work founding, in the words of a recent New York Times Magazine ad for an Upper East Side condominium complex, a new tradition. New traditions, actually, and quarrels among these traditions, both religious and secular, perched uneasily on the foundations of older traditions. In the historical land of Israel, as Leibovitz and I wrote, undercurrents of chosenness rattled the ground. Even as Zionists fiercely disputed all manner of things, including the nature of a Jewish state, and what policies to pursue, a spirit, one might even say a dybbuk of chosenness, inhabited them, and continues to do so. But in America, the old question came to the surface again: chosen for what? A good part of the answer would become, chosen for success. Jews were acculturated into a pot for partial melting. But also chosen to stand for justice, to complete Hillel's triad. It was another turn of the screw of ironic history that the Holocaust, as it came to be called, should have opened up American society for Jews. Barriers fell. Anti-Semitism withered both the genteel type and the murderous type. Restricted covenants were banned by the Supreme Court in 1948. University quotas were phased out. Turn-of-the-century Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe could join in the American celebration and give over their hearts to the newly founded Israel, even as their children were retreating from Yiddishkeit. Even as the Holocaust left us reeling, Jews overwhelmingly joined in a combination of redemptive spirit, old country nostalgia, and successful assimilation. Rituals of religious observance, holidays, and food, cleared for acceptance by dietary laws that were held to be inscribed with the imprimatur of God. The grandchildren, like myself, found ourselves freed for secular lives infused with what we thought of as Jewish values. This is a story for another day. Even as religious connections thinned out, Jews attend religious services at much lower rates than other religious denominations. The Jews, at least in America, became a people of ethics. In Cohen's words, Jews are ethnically hyperactive and religiously indolent. I would say also, ethically hyperactive. But here was yet another turn of the screw. The Holocaust now became a badge of Jewish identity. Whatever you thought about the Jews being chosen by God, our people had been singled out for the worst assaults ever delivered upon a whole people in modern history. A Christian might say that the Jews were crucified. And to have suffered this crucifixion, vicariously, to feel forever scarred by it, became a badge of identity. As Stephen Cohen wrote about his 1989 survey, the Holocaust is more important to more respondents than any other symbol of Jewishness. As many as 85% say it is at least very important, and 56% call it extremely important. Both figures exceed comparable rates for all other concepts in the series. The High Holidays, an attachment to Israel, God, the Torah, all of them. The Holocaust was the ultimate denial of equality, of dignity, of justice. And if anything, it only elevated the significance of the affirmative values that had been so atrociously annihilated by Nazi Germany. As the Holocaust became more central to the Jewish imagination, so did the ethical core of being Jewish, a commitment to equality, dignity, justice. So it is that the liberalism of American Jews has withstood decades of disillusion. It should not be surprising that, as Judge Richard Posner noted recently in the Washington Post, the three liberal justices besides Sotomayor are Jewish, though, as he quickly added, they are not, it seems, influenced by Judaism in their judicial work. not by Judaic doctrine, but by the penumbra of egalitarian ethics that, to most American Jews, feels like their birthright. So, what does Jewishness mean today, in America? Is there a core, an essential overlap, in the thick of all the family resemblances? Let's look at other social surveys, a quarter century after Stephen Cohen's. In 2012, the Public Religion Research Institute found that 87% of Jews said that the Holocaust was somewhat or very important for informing their political beliefs and activity. Nearly half, 46%, of American Jews cited a commitment to social equality as most important to their Jewish identity, twice as many as cited support for Israel, 20%, or religious observance, 17%. In 2013, a Pew poll found that the United States Jews see being Jewish as more a matter of ancestry, culture, and values than of religious observance. 6 in 10 say, for example, that being Jewish is mainly a matter of culture or ancestry, compared with 15% who say it is mainly a matter of religion. Roughly 7 in 10 say remembering the Holocaust and leading an ethical life are essential to what it means to them to be Jewish, while far fewer say observing Jewish law is a central component of their Jewish identity. And 2/3 of Jews say that a person can be Jewish even if he or she does not believe in God. The view that remembering the Holocaust is essential to what it means to be Jewish is shared by majorities in all of the large Jewish denominational groupings. As Hitler's movement had chosen the Jews for annihilation, the Jews could now choose themselves, not only as survivors but as redeemers. But what if there is no consensus on what it means to live an ethical life? What if a chasm divides the values of American Jews, diaspora Jews, from the Jews of the Jewish state? Between 1948 and 1967, American Jews could cherish the State of Israel on both particularist and universalist grounds. Israel was the state of the Jews, for sure. It had a part to play in the great universalism of nationhood. But it also leaned socialist. It could be exhibited as a case study of national liberation. Palestinians had no reality to the great majority of American Jews, but the Israeli victory in 1947-48 served both particularist and universalist needs. The Jews of the liberal left were doubly blessed. Be it Old Jerusalem or New, Holy Land, or God-fearing America as a city on a hill, the exalted state located elsewhere had long been, for the diaspora, a badge of identity, a palpable sign that history has a vector and of renewal. Pride in the survival indeed, the triumph of the Jewish state evoked pride. The Israeli victory in the Six-Day War for a while re-cemented the salience of the Holocaust. David had crushed Goliath. But in the conquest of the territories lay demon seeds. The statehood of Israel had the sanction of international law. It still does. But when Israel became an illegal occupier of the territories it conquered in 1967, it forfeited its universalist mantle. It made Israel look like a less compelling answer to the immense question of what might be left of chosenness, which dovetailed with the problem of what meaning might be found in the Holocaust. First under center-left labor governments and more radically under the Likud, Israel interpreted chosenness as a title to land and a warrant for defying world opinion and international law. It justified its aggressions as defenses. But this was an almost fatal mistake. Israeli exceptionalism abandoned the high moral ground. Gripped by messianism in a volatile brew of desperation and truculence, Israel defies the hard-fought achievements of the diaspora as it becomes steadily more illiberal, and thus more offensive to Jews who remain among America's most liberal populations. In a world of sinful nations, Israel now, simultaneously, claims the privilege of victimhood and the right to be honored as democratic even as it abandons liberality. This is a hell of a climb down from Tikkun Olam, the injunction to repair the world and welcome the stranger. It offers little solace or cohesion for American Jews. For the built-in ambiguities that face all minorities in America, Israel is no spiritual refuge. By now, a growing minority of younger American Jews are so intensely angry at the actually existing, increasingly illiberal Israel, which is no longer the Israel of Martin Buber and Paul Newman, as to reject Zionism as a dirty word and endorse the whole bundle of BDS politics, including the academic boycott, a direction made easier as American Jewish oligarchs fund land grabs and implant enclave fortresses in East Jerusalem and on the West Bank. Some are naive, some are thoughtless, some can think of no other way to get the Israeli government's attention. Not many liberal American Jews go so far, but the gulf that has opened up between Israeli and American Jews will be a fundamental feature of the Jewish landscape for a long time. Obviously, Israeli politics is in an inflammable state, in no small part because Palestinian politics are dead-ended. The polarization in Israel-Palestine generates aftershocks in America. And we are in the throes of a nasty feedback loop. When the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations lays claim to speak for American Jews, the Israeli philosopher Menachem Brinker has asked whether there are any minor Jewish organizations, it reveals itself helpless to resist the soft messianism and aggressive desperation of the West Bank occupation. The more the American Jewish establishment colludes with Netanyahu, the more damage the Israeli right does to the prospects for peace, and the more polarized are American Jews. As Israel becomes steadily more illiberal, it becomes more vexatious, more divisive for Jews who, all in all, remain among America's most liberal populations, and the younger the Jews, the more so. Minor Jewish organizations will likely proliferate. As a cement for American Jewish identity, the Holocaust is aging. The cracks will grow, and not only over Israel but whether the Jews are really a people of values, and if so, which they are. Schmaltz, however marketed, will not hold together a fractious population whose two world centers, Israel and America, are increasingly irreconcilable. The people of values are once again tested to decide what their values are. Which is where we came in. This text is adapted.
Well, that speech was given at Berkeley in California this last month. I think it was this last month. Wait a minute. Yeah, it was this last month. And it really tells you all you need to know about the Jewish situation, if you decipher it properly, or if you can decipher it at all. of course, the entire story, the ancient story, is totally nonsense, number one. That write all of it off. You know, there may have been some physical things that happened that were not spiritual or God or anything like that. But in, or they may have even had an army here or there and they did something. But in essence, all that belief system is bullshit. And the reason the United States has become the second Israel is because, and Europe suffered under it too, was because of what? Judaism. Christianity. Yeah, Christianity is just another form of Judaism. I mean, you know, you got all the Old Testament is Jewish, and the people talking in the New Testament were mostly Jewish too. They even say that their mythical, never existed Jesus was a Jew. So how can you expect anything different? How can you expect to get our race back on track in this country and Europe as long as we're buying into that crap where we have a little synagogue on every corner, which is a Christian church? Told you before, I'm very suspicious of that whole thing with Adolf Hitler and the Jews situation, because no matter how you look at it, Hitler was the father of Israel. Now, if he was out to kill all the Jews, why were over 3 or 4 million Jews transported and allowed to go to Israel to begin forming that Zionist nation? I believe that the National Socialism of Hitler was closely tied to Zionism itself. And most of what happened was a desire to gain territory and nationhood and all that kind of stuff. Which I know the Hollywood Nazis are not, they're going to have a problem with that, because a good share of those Hollywood Nazis claim to be Christians and go to Christian churches and all that, which you cannot be a true Aryan soldier or whatever you want to call it and include yourself in that crap. It's impossible. And even though that may seem to make our numbers even less than we thought, it's better to start with a solid foundation. If you're going to go anywhere, you can't go anywhere tied to Christ's insanity, which is Jewish. And you can't go anywhere tied to supporting Jews in any way. You should be involved in turning people who call themselves Jews away from Judaism itself. Because millions of people who refer to themselves as Jews, there's no physical evidence at all that they're connected to the Jews. All those tribes are gone. They got swallowed up. And a lot of these Jews are still trying to prove Jews are a race. Well, they can come from all kinds of races. I mean, we've got the Asian Jews, we got the black Jews, we got the white Jews. It's just the reverse of what normally you would think. They infiltrate races. They're gene hijackers. That is their power. They infiltrate. That's their. So now it's all coming around and it's all coming to a head. They're losing ground, especially among their own so-called people. They're split up in a million ways. And Israel's not going to last, which I have told you over and over again. Don't worry about Israel. Israel is going to go away. Either that or it's going to change its ways very radically. It's there where he says, the man that's giving the speech, is the Holocaust is aging. Of course, lies always age. Now, if they'd have kept to, you know, a few hundred thousand or maybe a million Jews died in the search for establishing Israel, the Zionists would be very, very well served by allowing a million Jews to die if it meant they gained Israel and the United States as colonies. And, of course, a lot of the Orthodox Jews realize that the worst thing that really ever happened to the Jews was Israel. And they were far better shaped, sprinkled around the world, to where they their power was limited. And they were able to exist quite well, living side by side with Arabs or who else. I mean, you know, these Jews lived beside those Arabs, and they lived in China, they lived in America, they lived all over the place, but their power was not so great that they couldn't be slapped down once in a while. Now they're slapping each other down. Netanyahu is the best thing going for us. because he's becoming so hated by Jews themselves for his Zionist positions, his right wing, so-called right wing. Yeah. Well, there's a lot more I could talk about this. Let me see. That's one reason that the Aryans have an upper hand if they recognize it and turn to it, because we are identifiable people. We're definitely identifiable people, where Jews are not. A Jew can be of any race. So as long as a significant number of Aryans remain intact all over the world, it would be not very hard to rebuild everything we've lost. But we have to, first of all, throw out the Abrahamic religions, all of them, and recognize who we are. Because, for an example, this Palmyra over in Syria that these idiots were destroying, if you look at the statues and so forth, they're all Aryan. Look at them. They're not Christian. They keep saying this is Christian. Bullshit. That was a pagan city built and run by Aryans. You don't see any Semitic-looking people on those monuments in Palmyra. But Jewish Christianity keeps trying to claim everything for themselves. Oh, they're destroying the Christian monuments. Bullshit. Anyhow. Well, I've told you also before how we come from a warrior race and like that. And once we get our ass to the wall, really get our ass to the wall, all through history, we've come out swinging. And these other people better get out of our way, including the progressive types and conservative types in this country that deny race. Anybody who denies race and racial differences and the nonsense of equality is your enemy. And when it comes down to the wire and the shots start being fired, it's going to be based on that. It's going to have a little of the aspects of ISIS. Not that I support anything ISIS, but their position is the warrior religion of Muslim. The Muslim religion is a warrior religion. And even though these people are not maybe the best ones to carry the banner, that's what it's all about. They're going to kill anybody that's not a Muslim. That's what the Quran says. Kill all the infidels. And the Bible says that. The Holy Christian Bible says that. Those that would not have me rule over them, bring them before me and slay them. That's the same thing. The Christians are saying the same thing. And if we don't get our race to understanding their Aryan background, they're going to use it on us, because we're still in a minority waking up. And so all the Abrahamic religions have built into them genocide. So remember that. They will use genocide against non-Jews, non-Christians, or non-Muslims. So when this thing starts, and it's already beginning, you better be prepared to do whatever, because you're going to have three factions coming after you. Three factions coming after old terrible Tommy. Now, I think I'm going to send this out in print form as an email. We're going to put this up on the website, too, and see what happens. It's going to be interesting what happens if enough people start reading what I've just put out.
In this country, people recognize that whatever they have just about has come from a battle. A battle against time, maybe, or a battle against the elements, and sometimes, unfortunately, a battle against their fellow man. One of the most famous of all those battles was fought right here in this place. This is where Jim Boy, Travis, and Davy Crockett stood. This is the Alamo. A 180 were challenged by Travis to die by the line that he drew with his sword when the battle was nigh. Any man that would fight to the death cross over, but him that would live better fly. And over the line was 179. Hey, Santa Ana, we're killing your soldiers below. That men, wherever they go, will remember the Alamo. Bowie lay dying, but his powder was ready and dry. Flat on his back, Bowie killed him a few in reply. And young David Crockett was singing and laughing with gallantry fierce in his eye. For God and for freedom, a man more than willing to die. Hey, Santa Ana, we're killing your soldiers below. That men, wherever they go, will remember the Alamo. Then they sent a young scout from the battlements, bloody and loud, with words of farewell from a garrison, valiant and proud. Grieve not, little darling, my dying. If Texas is sovereign and free, we'll never surrender and ever with liberty be. Hey, Santa Ana, we're killing your soldiers below. That men, wherever they go, will remember the Alamo.